Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks. For today and next week's episode, Oliver and I are debuting a new segment we're calling Take Two. And that's partly a shout out to the premise of the series. We realize that even after doing this show for over 150 episodes, salute, that there were artists and albums that we felt like deserved more or any attention. And we wanted an excuse to shine a light on them.
So we came up with a list of artists, and we chose two albums from each of their discographies, and we'll be creating a series of two-part episodes to discuss each album in detail.
Yes, Take Two is also a nod to how Oliver and I first met, paired together for all eternity, starting with the Tuesday Reviews Day segment that used to run on the Get It, Take Two morning show on KPCC. And we want to shout out Jacob Margolis, our original producer there, as well as A. Martinez, our host.
Our first Take Two artist is, drumroll,
Janet Jackson. And to be more specific, we'll be talking today about her 1986 album, Control. And next week, it'll be 1997, The Velvet Rope. When I was 17, I did what people told me, did what my father said, and let my mother mold me. But that was long ago. Are these my confessions? Shouts to Usher. Well, I'll never tell. But these are, in fact, the opening bars to the title track of an album by one Janet Demita Jo Jackson, released on February 4th, 1986, A&M Records. It wasn't her first album. She'd already dropped Janet Jackson in 1982 and Dream Street in 1984. But some shifts had happened in the 2 years since. For starters, Janet fought the law of patriarchy. But the law didn't win this time. She did. And she left Joe Jackson and his business in 1986 and never looked back. Second, there were new sonics and a vibe change. While she had had a taste of the Minneapolis sound because of her work with Jesse Johnson, on Control, she embraced the movement, the whole movement, and a sound notable for its funk, its synth, and the Roland TR-808 drum machine. The results? So many hits. Also, in the last couple of years, Janet Jackson grew up. Whereas she'd repped lighter PG-rated fare on previous cuts, Control was, to say the least, much more adult and much more contemporary. Control gave us the scoop on the youngest member of a notoriously squeaky clean-seeming family, because Janet said some stuff and whispered some stuff that made me think she was no longer a good girl. And in as much as confession is good for the soul, I'll say that I was here for it, times a trillion. As Jay-Z said, once a good girl's gone bad, she's gone forever. Perhaps, and here are a few other things that got gone during the Control era. Bubblegum pop and the sidelines. Because along came Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, purveyors of crossover appeal, dance floor R&B, and that fire. They won a Producer of the Year Grammy for this one and got Janet her first nod for female R&B performance. Also gone? The bright colors. On this album, Janet debuted those black garments that would become her signature look for the next few years. Gone was underachieving. Dream Street sold 44,000 copies. Control? 10 million. Gone was the patented shoulder shimmy two-step combo. It was during this album that we saw just what Janet Jackson was working with, courtesy of a then-unknown Paula Abdul, who came in and gave Janet all that good hand and foot geometry. Gone was her big brother's shadow. By 1986, the paparazzi had famously zoomed its lens on Michael, giving Janet just the wee crease she needed to step into the limelight. And so, Gone was the ingenue. Control created an icon. And to think, the concept for a lot of this began because of a situation Janet faced in the streets we'll get into later. But let me say this, though. In 1986, the term female gaze wasn't quite in vogue yet, but this album reps that hard. While the songs were written by men, they represent the voice and the choice of a confident young woman to flee the nest, remix what we thought about her, and strike a sonic pose. Over the nine tracks that make up Control, we meet a 19-year-old woman who's fierce, What Have You Done For Me Lately, slow jam sexy, like on Funny How Time Flies, and free, when I think of you. What this album gave music can in no way be summed up on this episode, but the vastness of its influence can be seen in the careers of Britney, Christina, Beyoncé, and Taylor. It's the blueprint for pop superstardom. It's the definition of moxie. It's what happens when bubblegum becomes extra. Heat rock, for sure. An album that bumps eternally, for sure. And I'm gonna let Janet finish, but this is also a story about control.
My control. Control of what I say, control of what I do. And this time I'm gonna do it my way. I hope you enjoy this as much as I do. Are we ready? I am. 'Cause it's all about control. And I've got lots of it.
Morgan, Janet Jackson was your suggestion for one of the Take Two artists we should tackle. Why is that?
Well, you know, since our episode with B. Slade, where he broke down Rhythm Nation so beautifully, and just a shameless plug here, please do go check out our live episode with B. Slade. But since then, I've been hoping someone would come on the show to talk about some of Janet's other albums, but no one has. So I thought she'd be great. A great artist to kick this series off with. She's obviously iconic, and she's got a ton of trinkets, including an Oscar nomination for Best Original Song, first woman to be nominated for Producer of the Year in the Grammy category, 27 top 10 hits. She holds the record for the most consecutive top 10 hits on the U.S. Billboard Top 100 chart by a female artist. She's also the first and only artist in history to have 7 top 5 hits from one album, and that was from Rhythm Nation. All total, she's got 203 awards and has been nominated 558 times. So, she's major. And I thought, let's talk about one of the greatest pop artists, I think, in music history.
Yeah, and if we're going to go there, I think Control has to be on that list. Obviously, if we hadn't already done Rhythm Nation, as you pointed out with B. Slade, that would have been in contention. But you cannot talk about Janet Jackson and her career without talking about Control.
Correct. And we can't talk about Control without also talking about the whole 9-minute video that kicked the album off. And I just want you to hear a bit of it, because not only did it kick off the album, but I think it also... the scenario is what kicked off her dilemma, or what's supposed to have kicked off the dilemma.
Don't you think it's about time I moved out of here and got my own place? I found a real cute apartment in Westwood. It's really nice.
Westwood?
I put a deposit on it already. You can see it tomorrow.
No. You're not getting any apartment in Westwood or any place else by yourself.
Well, wait a minute. Can't we even talk about this?
There's nothing to talk about.
I don't need a limo.
So yeah, beef with her father because she wanted to strike out on her own, and strike out she did. Westwood is overrated anyway, and she went on to do her own thing. The rest of the video has Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis meeting up with her and the band to go scoop her up to take her to record. So I think it sets the tone of her having beef with her father, and you know, those are lyrics from Control.
Yeah. I thought it makes sense, especially given the context of the video and really the context of this album and in its title, which is something that I just never really appreciated much back in the 80s because I was too young to really fully understand the full backstory. But what strikes me about thinking about Janet in this moment in her career and in her life, especially on Control, is how on the one hand, she was obviously part of the Jackson family, but to me, she always felt like she was outside of the core of the Jackson 5 and really even outside of the orbit of her brother Michael. And whether that was by intent or circumstance, though it definitely feels like it was at least partially by intent, Janet seemed like she wanted to find a path to her own success out of her siblings, out of the family business, so to say, which makes it, I think, all the more remarkable that when we think back, two of the biggest pop stars of the 1980s were brother and sister, despite having largely done so without the other's help, because it's not like Michael had given Janet like a big feature on Bad. And likewise, even though the two of them would eventually record together, Janet's success always seemed to be in parallel with, but not a product of Michael's success. And if you really think about how rare and unusual that is, it really just makes that feat of both of them even more impressive.
For sure. I mean, and to have, you know, have signed two of the biggest contracts. They both signed two of the biggest contracts in recording history.
Huge.
For the time, I think Madonna is the only person that signed a contract that large. Their tours, the massiveness of their tours, what they were able to make from touring and merch, and that they came from the same household, which was a lot of things, but Repressive was one of them, and struck out to go in two different directions. And comparatively, that it's not to say that Janet was without scandal, but certainly not the level of scandal that Michael had, and not the level of sort of this beating in the media. She did take her own little beats in the media, but she had it, I'm not going to say she had it easier, she had it different. On top of her being a multimedia artist, she was also coming into her own, and to your point, pulling away from the Jacksons, which is no small feat. I mean, we know that Joe Jackson had an iron hand, right? But we come into the decade with her doing her self-titled debut, and she's 16. And you can tell he's still sort of crafting her image. It's so bubblegum. I mean, if you look at some of the videos on YouTube, it is. She has this interview that she does on American Bandstand. Then you get to Dream Street, and I have a jam on Dream Street called "If It Takes All Night." And if we could hear a little bit of that, Christian. Christian, I see you groove into that, but that is fire, though. I know it sounds super 80s, but shout out to the 80s. And on top of that, she was also getting her acting on. I mean, to go from like a Mae West impersonator to Penny on Good Times, like a key role on Good Times, then go to Bubblegum Pop Star, and then show it back on the airwaves and in our lives, giving herself permission to be. And she did all that before people were ready, but she got us ready. And it didn't seem like it mattered.
Where's the love for her cameo star turn on Different Strokes? Because that was my introduction. Because I never watched Good Times. But I did watch Different Strokes, where she played Willis's girlfriend for,
sure,
I forget how
did.
Many episodes. Like, she kind of popped in, I don't know, maybe like three or so. But that was my intro to Janet. Yeah.
Yeah, she did have a she did have a hell of a cameo.
Hi, Willis.
Hi, Charlene.
You're not wearing your retainers.
I didn't want you to melt them.
I want to meet my sister Kimberly and my little brother Arnold.
Hey. No wonder he's willing to risk the best years of his life.
You're pretty cute yourself too, Arnold.
Some people say I resemble Billy Dee Williams.
You know, I'm glad you brought up her previous albums, because to be straight up with you, before we prep for this, I knew in the back of my head, I knew Control wasn't her first album, but I had absolutely no memory of what came before it. And except for the album covers, because I've seen the self-titled debut. I've seen that at record stores. She's looking very young, very cute. But
yeah,
I looked at the track listing, and not a single one of those songs remotely came to mind. So I think myself, and I don't think I'm alone in this, a lot of us really discovered Janet Jackson through Control, because her first two albums, I'm not going to say they weren't flops, but they certainly underperformed for what we expected from a Jackson family member. And I don't think it's surprising that they're not very well remembered LPs, especially compared to everything that came after Control, with Control and then after.
I totally agree. And they also didn't stand out. Even though it was Janet Jackson, they were so wedded in that sound that they sounded a lot like a lot of other 80s sort of cheesy synthy. I say that, and I had jams on both of those albums. But yeah, in retrospect, they sound like a lot of other stuff that was coming out at the time. And so they didn't make a big splash, even though it was Janet Jackson. It was young Janet Jackson.
Right. And a Janet Jackson who was not in, drum roll, in Control yet. And the thing that I just did not appreciate, even though it's not as if she's even being subtle on the beginning of Control the Song. And you hear the same lyrics being said, or not even lyrics, but she says the same monologue in the video that you were referencing before, is that I'm in control now. And that when I first heard that song back in 86, I was young. I didn't process, well, what does that mean in terms of her taking creative control of her life and her career? And I'm sure she probably pissed off Joe Jackson, her father, but pretty sure history bears out that Janet Jackson being in control, pretty smart move from a musical and career point of view, because
absolutely,
that's where everything changed once she was the one calling the shots instead of her father or whatever handlers were around her. It also marked Control, the beginning of what would become inarguably one of the most fruitful collaborations in modern pop history, which is mm-hmm. Janet Jackson working with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. And I was struck by how on the occasion of Control's 30th anniversary a few years ago, Wesley Morris, who I typically think of as a film critic, but he wrote about Control for the New York Times. And one of the things that he wrote about the collaboration between the three of them with this album is, quote, "It still sounds today as much like 1986 as it does 2056. Some producers make hooks. These three made wedgies," unquote, which is, this is why Wesley Morris has a Pulitzer and I don't, is because he can make a wedgie sound poetic somehow. But you can't deny that those three, they alchemized gold out of whatever they threw into the mix.
Sure, sure. And that was part of, I think a great critical decision on Janet's part to wrestle control of her career away from one man and put in the hands of two. Not bad. Not a bad two to put your career in the hands of Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. And also too, the timing of it all, like this is after Thriller and before Bad. So she had just a little bit of lane to sneak her career through while people were, when the tabloids were attacking her brother. In retrospect, that is sort of gully, and maybe it wasn't on purpose. But while he was sort of tripping, she slid in the back with these two. And and the rest, as they say, is history. And I want to play a little bit of this piece where Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis are speaking at the Red Bull Music Academy about their experience with Control.
We didn't go in the studio for like the first 4 or 5 days. We just hung out, went to the movies, went to the club, went to the lake, and just hung out, right? And about 5 days in, she said, "When are we going to actually start working?" And we said, "Oh, we've been working," and we showed her the lyrics to Control. And she started reading the lyrics, and she said, "Well, wait, this is what we've been talking about." And we said, "Exactly." And she said, "So whatever we talk about, that's what we're going to write about?" Like, "Yeah." And she said, "Oh, okay." And it was like a light bulb went off in her head, because nobody had ever asked her what she wanted to write about or sing about. Well, first of all, nobody asked her to write. Nobody asked her what she wanted to sing about. They just gave her songs. And we were like, no, you got to be part of the process here. And that's how the Control record started. And obviously ended up being a very pivotal record in all of our careers.
I'm curious how you think the two of them fit into the pantheon of, when we think back on the sound of the 80s, their names have to be part of that conversation. But what I'm curious about here is, because I feel like you can draw a lot of parallels between the kind of production they were doing on this album and the stuff that Prince was doing. And of course, those two, all three of those folks shared a lot of the same roots and had their careers happen in parallel. What is it that you think Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis brought to the game in the 80s?
The funk. To keep it short and simple, there's something about that Minneapolis sound that's just so funky. It's the synth, it's the bass, it's the glitchiness. There's just something about that sound that it always sounds like a jam session and the vocalist just showed up. And you hear that on a lot of songs that people forget that they did, like Cheryl Lynn's Encore, or New Edition's If It Isn't Love, or Patti Austin's The Heat of Heat. The thread that links all three of these songs is that the sound is big and it's funky. Like, if you don't read the liner notes, you think it's 35 people in there playing. You know what I'm saying? You don't know how many personnel's in there. It's just this thing. And it showed up on the time records, not just Prince, but it showed up on the time. And if you hear some of those interludes between songs, it's just a long jam session, and that's what they brought. I wish I had been able to get like just the instrumental of Control, because I just wanted to listen to the instrumentals without the vocals, so I could talk a little bit more about that sound. But it's just this thing. And for those people listening in, if you go back over Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis's discography and listen to and check out some of the songs that they did that you don't know that they did, it'll tell you a lot about the sound and what makes them so big for the 80s.
One of the things I was reading about Control in hindsight, in retrospect, is how some folks at least credit this with really inventing or helping to kickstart New Jack Swing as a sound.
And,
you and I have certainly talked about New Jack Swing many a time over our episodes. And I always think of New Jack Swing more in its late 80s, early 90s rendition, but I get why Control, or just the sound that Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis were coming up with on this album in 86, could be seen as that starting point. And to what you were saying earlier, it has everything to do with how they capture this particular sound of funk.
Yeah.
It's dance music, but it's not, I mean, it's very, I'm trying to think of how to articulate this right, but number one, it's so distinctive. That Minneapolis sound, as you were saying before, is so key there.
Yeah.
And even though I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of New Jack Swing in comparison to other forms of hip hop style production that would emerge by decade's end, I absolutely love what it is that they're doing here, because you can hear how each component falls into place and just works with each other to produce that funk sound that we're talking about. And we'll get deeper into this in the second half when we get into some of the specific songs. But that's the thing about Control. It is a short album. It's only 9 songs, but you get that funk on every moment that you hear across those 42, 43 minutes.
Yep. Yes, indeed. And their sound is just so on point that it can handle very soft vocals like Janet and very big vocalists like Alexander O'Neill. It is grown folks funky and can handle itself in any setting, in any genre. That, to me, is the genius of Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis.
I know this is a tough question, but that's what we're here for. So between Control and Rhythm Nation, which of course are the definitive 1980s Janet albums, which one's the better album? And before I'm going to answer my own question, so you're not just purely on the hot seat here, because I've been thinking about this a lot this week. I think Rhythm Nation is the better album in terms of it's much more of a concept album, the way in which it's constructed, the whole panoply of videos that went with the songs. I mean, it was engineered and planned out from A to Z, right? That said, I think Control is the more fun listen. Like, if I just got to sit down with a Janet album from that era, I think probably, I'm not going to say 9 times out of 10, but I'll say 8 times out of 10, I'm going to go with Control, because from a pure pop pleasure, we talk about the pleasure principle that she brings up, right? I think Control just nails this in a way. Not to say that Rhythm Nation is somehow ponderous or less enjoyable. It's just enjoyable in a different way.
I completely agree. I'm excited at the beginning of Control, I'm pissed at the beginning of Rhythm Nation. After the State of the World, the Race, the Knowledge, I like the concept. I love that she's speaking truth to power and all the themes. There's a lot of songs. There's 20 songs on that album. That's a lot of stuff. And although there are jams, I mean, I have my specifics. Love Will Never Do, Escapade. I could go on and on. Lonely, Come Back to Me. I'm not arguing the jams. But there's something about Control. And maybe, we'll do, a series on, we talked about sophomore albums, but we got to do a series on firsts, because there's something special about first albums, whether they're the best or not. And I've just got an attachment to that. Rhythm Nation.
But controls a third album. It's not a first. That's the whole thing, right?
It's the first as like that Janet. You know what
there
I'm saying?
You go.
It's the first with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. And so it feels like, I mean, unless somebody that's tuning in is like, you know, they're really wedded to Dream Street and Janet. But this is Janet on her own. So it's the first as that's, it's the first thing right. that shot her to stardom. And so that's the right. way it feels to me. So Rhythm Nation, I don't know, man. I hate to criticize it because there's some, you know, she's trying to make a, you know, social statement and be positive out here. But I don't
see it as a critique. I mean, one can enjoy one album over the other without it being, it's not as if we're saying that Rhythm Nation is lesser as a quality. It just,
sure.
But it's not as fun because it's,
right.
it's a heavier album. It's meant to be a heavier album in that way.
It's heavy. It is
right.
heavy.
I just got to say, it's interesting to me that we have been on this run of third albums, right?
Yeah.
We did an episode about Aquemini, right? Outkast's
yeah.
third album. We did one about Blue Magic's 13 Blue Magic Lane, their third
yeah.
album. And somehow
yeah, yeah.
we start the take two on Janet with her third album, though, as you said, you could say it's symbolically a first album because it's this reinvention. I was saying before that we don't spend enough time talking about third albums in general, but somehow we have managed, not through any kind of design, just through circumstance, we've actually ended up having a lot of really fruitful conversations about people's third album. So maybe there's something there. Maybe we need to reinvent the impression that people come away and make third albums
the
important ones.
I think so. There's some sort of magic. And I think we're going to come across like, what great third album are we missing? Because if we, I think that'd be great to... I think that'd be great to go down the road to.
Well, we will be back with more of our Take Two conversation about Janet Jackson's Control after you hear from some of our sibling Max Fun podcasts. Keep it locked.
Hi, I'm Jackie Cation.
Hi, I'm Lori Kilmartin.
And we have a podcast called The Jackie and Lori Show. Who are you, Lori Kilmartin?
Oh my God, so much pressure. I'm a stand-up. I've been doing stand-up since 1987. I'm a writer for Conan. I've written a couple books, have a couple CDs out, have a special out. Who are you, Jackie?
Well, I too am a stand-up comic since 1984. And I do the road like a maniac and don't have a cool writing job, but I have four albums out, working on a new album. We talk about stand-up. We talk about all the different parts of stand-up comedy. So that's the Jackie and Lori Show, and you should subscribe on Maximum Fun if you want to hear that.
And I would encourage you not to.
Hey, Jay Keith.
Hey, Helen. Hey, you've got another true-false quiz for me?
Yep. Our trivia podcast, Go Fact Yourself, used to be in front of a live audience.
True. Turns out that's not so safe anymore.
Correct. Next. Unfortunately, this means we can no longer record the show.
False. The show still comes out every first and third Friday of the month.
Correct. Finally, we still have great celebrity guests answering trivia about things they love on every episode of Go Fact Yourself.
Definitely true.
And for bonus points, name some of them.
Recently, we've had Ophira Eisenberg, plus tons of surprise experts like Yardley Smith and Suzanne Summers.
Perfect score.
Woo!
You can hear Go Fact Yourself every first and third Friday of the month with all the great guests and trivia that we've always had. And if you don't listen, well, then you can go fact yourself.
That's the name of our podcast.
Correct.
Woo!
And we are back on Heat Rocks with part one of our Take Two conversation about Janet Jackson and her 1986 album, Control.
So, Morgan, as we often ask our guests, do you remember how you first crossed paths with this album? I actually never owned the album. I only knew the singles, so I don't have an answer to this. How about you?
Do I ever? So, first of all, I scooped it up at the Warehouse. And shout out to the Warehouse. Warehouse Records on La Brea and Obama Boulevard. It was Rodeo Boulevard back then. She had a...
I was going to say.
Yeah, it was Rodeo Boulevard back in the day, right on the corner in that little strip mall. behind the Sizzler. She had an in-store signing. Shout out to the Sizzler.
Whoa.
Shout out to the Sizzler. And because one of my mother's students worked at the Sizzler, she was like, if you want to, shout out to the Sizzler. She was like, if you want to come through after, because at that time I was just crazy for all you can eat shrimp. But she was like, if you want to come through after, it's cool. So of course I came through after. Anyway, there was an in-store signing packed out in that capacity, and I didn't get in. It was that thick, but I got a signed copy of the album anyway. But I was in line for a really long time. And
yeah,
it's not cool to be in long lines when you're short. But when you're a fanatic of an artist like I was for Janet and that album, I stayed. And I took the album insert out and put it on my wall because it was all Art Deco and cool, the red and her, you know, the angles of her her shoulder pads. And I do remember being hyped and not skipping any songs. It was definitely for me a moment, for sure a moment.
How is it that you were such a big fan of Janet when she hadn't really blown up in a big, big way until this album? So what was it about her pre-Control that made you a fan of hers?
You know what? What I mentioned, like her as an actress. So some of that stuff, I had fallen in love with her character on Good Times.
Yeah.
She represented a lot of black girls growing up in the 70s and 80s. Even though she was from that family, to your point, she always sort of felt like an outlier, right? And so I guess in some ways I saw myself, you know, in her.
Mm.
And I wasn't expecting this album to come out, so it was a real surprise. I don't remember there being a whole lot of press, but I remember when I heard that there was an album coming out, I was excited about that. And also, too, this is the 80s where the video age is coming, you know, coming of age, and it's MTV. And so I knew that there were going to be videos out, and I couldn't wait for that. So it was just a moment for me.
Sitting in the movie show, thinking nasty thoughts. I better be a gentleman, or you turn me off. That's right.
We talked about this just briefly in the first half, the fact that the Control video is this 9-minute mini movie, certainly a little bit autobiographical. Feel like she cast someone to play her stern dad who does that role very well.
Yes.
But the impression that I think a lot of people, well, let me just speak for myself at least, is that it was impossible to separate Janet Jackson's musical career from what she was doing on the music video level. And of course, at this point in the mid 80s, music videos were such an important part of how a lot of us experienced music, period, because MTV was basically still getting off its feet, but had really become this international phenomenon. And certainly Janet, you know, similar to her brother Michael, were, you know, they were just changing the game with the videos that they were producing that go with the songs.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I mean, Control is a whole 9-minute video and it's live. You've got the band, you've got Jimmy and Terry in there. When you look back at that, when you look back at those videos, you see Janet's influence. You see that she paved the way for Beyonce. You see that she paved the way for that matter, for Britney Spears, for Lady Gaga. That these like big performances and performance videos and all the dancers, that came straight from Janet. That came straight from Janet and Control. So I think this is the album that a lot of these artists will cite as an influence in their careers. And it starts with those big dramatic videos that she had in Control.
And the level of choreography in particular is just unmatched. And that's not to throw shade on anyone else who had very good choreographers, you know, and dancers in their videos.
Sure.
But I mean, who was tackling or taking on anything on the level that Janet Jackson was in that moment?
Nobody at the time. Nobody at the time. And shout out to Paula Abdul.
Oh, is that, that's right. That's how Paula got started. She was Janet's choreographer.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, Paula with the Scat Cat, bringing that hip hop R&B fusion in the game early.
The rap, so mic it. Here's a little story, and you're sure to like it. Swift and sly, and I'm playing it cool with my homegirl, Paula Abdul.
One of the things I I did appreciate about Janet Jackson now, I don't think I would have said it back then, is that she really did not try to pander to make her stuff, musically speaking, you know, more contemporary with whatever was going on. Like, I never felt like, at least not in that era, that Janet was trying to hop on a fad just to do it. And so even though she could have easily, I mean, again, this album comes out in 1986, the same year as Run DMC with Raising Hell. A lot of seminal hip hop albums are beginning to come out. And even though there are elements of hip hop that, of course, appear on this album, especially in Rhythm Nation, she wasn't trying to cross over to that. Like, she knew what her lane was and how she wanted to define it. And she didn't feel like she had to go out and just put a rapper on there just for the sake of, because that was the thing to do in the mid late 80s.
I totally agree. And I think this is just classic pop R&B, period. I think people would consider her a pop star, but it was pop R&B, you know, and that's it, period. And I think maybe that staying in your lane is the key to consistency, or it certainly was in the 80s, because she had hit after hit after hit without varying.
Right. And this was an incredibly consistent album, which makes this next question, I think, exceptionally hard to answer, which is, what is the fire track off of Control? And my God, are there a lot of things that you can choose from?
Well, if you had asked me before, I might have said the title track, because it just means so much to me. And because it was the first one out of the gate, and its opening is just, to me, is unmatched. But in prep for the chat and listening to it, and over the years, I've fallen in love with Pleasure Principle. Pleasure Principle is fire. Ooh-wee. That's the one right there. And I love the intensity of it. I love the chorus. I love the grownness of the lyrics, where she says, what I thought was happiness was only part-time bliss. Only part-time bliss. You can take a bow. The choreography in the video. You have to see the video. I'm sure people that have that are familiar with this album that love Janet Jackson, they always talk about the Pleasure Principle video, because it's just her in a loft, all black. She's got the shirt, you know, tied up at the waist, the black jeans. She got on knee pads. Like, she came to party, okay, period. She's giving you black flash dance vibes, doing all types of, you know, foot geometry with a chair. And it's just fire. That song bumps. I was playing it at loud decibels in prep for the chat. And this, for me, is the fire track. What about you?
Super tough, because there's so many gems on here. I want to say, and I have trouble remembering now, what, 30 plus years, but I think back then I probably would have said When I Think of You. So I'm going to stick with that. And the reason why I would have chosen it then, and certainly why I'm giving it a shout out now, is I think it is just an absolutely perfect pop song. It's fun. It's light. It's got crazy hooks for days. It doesn't necessarily have the same bite, either musically or lyrically, as Nasty or maybe What Have You Done For Me Lately. But to me, When I Think of You, it just flirts in that same tier of perfect, feel-good, party pop songs as Whitney's I Want to Dance with Somebody or Prince's When You Were Mine.
Yes.
And I mean, to this day, just listening to that song fills me with such joy and pleasure. So, gotta give it up to that.
Chewy.
And before I forget to mention this, one of the things that in general I never loved about 80s production was just the gated drums, whether it was a drum machine or in more, most cases probably acoustic drums, but produced in a way to that gives it that very 80s sound. Never loved it. I mean, I'm a boom bap guy, right? So I wanted the stuff to sound like it did with the James Brown band. That's not what happened in the 80s. But I completely forgive whatever they wanted to do with the drum programming and production on here, because everything works so beautifully in concert with one another. Every element just hums. And so even though I don't love the drums on their own, in addition to everything else, I couldn't imagine it any other way than sounding like they do here. But it's a tough one. Like I said, it's tough because if you're talking about just, again, the craft of a perfect pop song, there's no way that you can listen to, let's say, Nasty and say, that's not a perfect pop song, because that also hits all of those marks as well, as does Control, as does What Have You Done For Me Lately. So it's, you know, I use this phrase at times, but to me, When I Think of You is the first amongst equals.
Sure. And Nasty, I'm glad that you're mentioning Nasty for two reasons, because the opening of Nasty to me is just so sick production-wise. Yeah. Christian, if we could hear from the beginning.
Give me a beat!
I mean, that just that opening, it's not exactly boom bap, but it's boom bap-ish-esque. I love how big it is. I love the bounce, and I just love her calling out. Nasty's one of my favorites, not the favorite.
Yeah,
but one of my favorites. But I did come across an interview with Janet on Jimmy Fallon, and she talks about the inspiration behind Nasty. And I never knew this story before I found this on YouTube. We can take a listen to it.
Did you realize it was going to become iconic when you?
No, I mean, you're just creating music, you know. No, I never did, and the story is crazy.
What was the story?
Once again, in Minneapolis, and my friend and I, we were on our way. I'd never taken a dance class, so she had this great idea to take a dance class. We were staying downtown at a hotel, at a loft, and walking out of the hotel, there were like five or six older guys up against the, you know, standing up against the wall, and they just basically started messing with us. Oh, and
like catcalling us?
Yeah, and I didn't like it very much, and I was pretty embarrassed, and I was actually pretty upset. And I came back to the studio that night and told Jimmy and Terry about my experience, and it turned into the song Nasty.
Wow, yeah. That is a crazy story. Yeah, because my first name ain't Baby.
It's Janet.
Miss Jackson at the Nasty.
I didn't even know the backstory. I really didn't know.
Same here.
What cat calls do to a catalog. My God.
I know. Say nasty, nasty boys. I don't mean a thing. Oh, you nasty boys. Nasty, nasty boys. I don't mean a change. Oh, you nasty boys.
Morgan, you got favorite moments off this album?
The opening of Control.
Yeah.
The opening of Control. I do love a mantra. What about you? Mm.
Favorite moment is how When I Think of You opens. And I always love it when a song goes instrument by instrument so that it builds over the course of, usually it's, they bring in something new every, what, two bars or so. And this to me is just a master class in how you do that, where you just introduce and build a song from just one instrument, one sound. I just love how each new ingredient gets dropped in, and each one of those new ingredients is equally delicious. Is there a song on here that you would either want to hear covered or that you think encapsulates something essential about Janet Jackson that you would use as an introduction to somebody who had never heard this album, had never heard Janet before?
If there was a song to be covered, I'd love to see or hear a Janae Aiko cover Funny How Time Flies. And if I had to introduce someone to this album, I'd start with Control. Because yeah. Control not only sets the tone for this album, but it lets you know that before we got to the Janet, it started with Control. And again, not to take away from Janet or Dream Street, because right. I have jams right. on there. But this was right. the thing.
Of course. One song we haven't really talked much about, even though it was, at least when I was growing up, it was heavy on the radio, which is Let's Wait a While, which I think is a very interesting song because usually when we talk about a female artist in particular taking control of their career, oftentimes that's accompanied by a taking control of their depiction of their own sexuality. And Control could have been a moment in which Janet, as part of her breaking loose from the grip of her family and of her father in particular, she could have gone in a more hypersexualized direction. I mean, we've seen that happen with many other artists, but Let's Wait a While is so literally and figuratively virginal, right? You know, it's a song about not having sex. And it made sense, I think, especially from a safe sex point of view, perhaps. This is the mid-90s, after all, AIDS crisis is swirling around us. But it's such an interesting choice for a song. I don't think it's necessarily surprising, perhaps given her age. It's not like a weird song. It's just not a song that you hear a lot of people doing these days, regardless of age. And I was thinking about if there was a song on here, not that I would necessarily want to hear it covered, but I could imagine like an up-and-coming Disney pop star covering Let's Wait a While, because it would be so on brand with like
sure.
the very family-oriented Disney stees. It's not my favorite song off the album, but I like it. It's the light ballady Janet that we would get a lot more of later. This album is not super heavy on the ballads, and it's very sweet. It's a very sweet song.
And it's got that innocence. And we've got a couple of albums until she isn't waiting anymore, right? So we don't get to Anytime, any place until Janet, which is 1993, the other Janet yeah. album. And then obviously yeah. Velvet Rope, where she ain't hardly waiting. You know what I mean?
Remember the special night when all of the stars were shining bright. We made our first endeavor to stay together.
If you had to choose three words to describe Control, what three words would you choose?
I'm running this.
Spot on.
And be real honest, but on that very first night, it wasn't quite right.
All right, before we wrap this up, as always, let us leave our audience members with something else to put onto the playlist. I would recommend dialing it back 2 years and go to Madonna's Like a Virgin from 1984. It's another 9-song, hit-laden album by, I think, the only other female artist of the decade who was on Janet's level in that era. And that's not any disrespect to Whitney, because obviously she was big, but I think Houston's career crosses into the early 90s and then goes supernova. So I think if we're just talking strictly 80s output, One and two, you can argue between Madonna and Janet. You're both probably right. And then Whitney comes in third within that. So I think Like a Virgin, in the same way that Control made Janet's career, Madonna's Like a Virgin, which was, I believe, her sophomore album, is what made Madonna Madonna. And so I think there's a lot of parallels between those two. And just from a pure 80s pop point of view, you can't go wrong with the main hits off of either album. So that's my rec.
And I'd take it back to 1985 in an album called High Priority by Sherelle. It's also mostly produced. I'd say 98% of that's produced by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. So you get the same vibe, the same sound.
That will do it for this inaugural Take Two episode. And next time, we will be jumping forward 11 years into the future by talking about Janet Jackson's 1997 album, The Velvet Rope. Stay tuned for that. You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.